GTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Friday, November 17th. Cloudy and windy, rain developing in the afternoon. Today's high 43, winds up to 20 miles per hour later today. Right now, wind from the south at 13, 37 degrees Racine, 36 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. What an interesting story we are exploring in this portion of WGTD's morning show. The story of one of America's most illustrious families, the Brown family, and probably the most vivid way in which this name lives on into modern America is that they helped to establish and rename what is still known as Brown University, a highly regarded school located in Providence, Rhode Island. And behind that name of Brown is a really fascinating story of a complicated family spanning more than 10 generations. And Sylvia Brown, my morning show guest, is part of that family. And we're going to learn from her about what prompted her to write this book called Grappling with Legacy, Rhode Island's Brown Family and the American Philanthropic Impulse, a dramatic and kind of unpleasant event which occurred that, in a sense, galvanized her to tell the full story and in fair fashion about her family and its long, rich legacy in this country. And the book is also an exploration of what it means to give, to be philanthropic, and the book even offers a few thoughts about the way in which one can thoughtfully donate to cares to concerns that one deeply cares about. Sylvia Brown considers herself a philanthropist and also what she likes to call a smart giving advocate. And this book, again, is called Grappling with Legacy, published by Archway. Sylvia Brown, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. So I alluded to kind of an unpleasant moment that really served as at least as the primary catalyst for you wanting to write this book, exploring the history of your own family. It was roughly 13, 14 years ago. Tell us what you heard said in an event at Brown University.
Indeed. Well, let me give you a little bit of background. Of course, I grew up in a family that was steeped in philanthropy. I myself have my entire professional career worked in economic development and more recently in donor education. And in 1995, my father decided to give away most of his inheritance to Brown University. But less than a decade later, I found myself, as you mentioned, in the first public forum of the university's newly created Committee on Slavery and Justice, which was supposed to examine the origins of the university to see if it had been founded with money made in the slave trade. And as I sat in the auditorium, one of the speakers came up on stage and said, "There were no good Browns." And I took that like a punch in the stomach, because I wondered if I had been fed a pack of lies. I'd been taught to admire my ancestors, particularly my grandfather and my father. And suddenly all that came crashing down. So I decided to investigate my ancestors, particularly in the 18th century, when America's economy was fueled by the slave trade. And I discovered a story that spans 10 generations, not just this one generation in the 18th century. And the more I researched, the more fascinated I became with the way in which the Brown family mirrors the story of American giving. Why do Americans give? Why is charitable giving such a hallmark of our American ethos? Mm. And that led me to write the book.
Very good. We're going to spend the rest of our time talking about your family and this, and all that you uncovered. But I want to ask you just one follow-up about this disturbing experience when this speaker from the podium said what she did about your family, and in such blunt fashion. I'm just curious if you had a chance to confront the speaker and ask why this was said, or why it was said in the way it was said. Were you able to get an answer to that question? I mean, was some sort of point trying to be made, and was it framed in kind of shocking fashion, since obviously that event was happening at Brown University, it was sponsored by Brown University. Do you have any sense of why the speaker said what they did?
Yes. She was referring specifically, or her remarks before that point were referring specifically to an ancestor of mine who was an abolitionist who freed his slaves. He was one of the first to free his slaves. And not only that, but he gave them land, he set up savings accounts for them, he taught them how to read, and so forth. And she was saying that this was extremely patronizing, and that even though at the time what he was doing was considered wonderful, it really was not. And then she moved on to just saying generally that nothing anybody had done through the ages could be considered good.
Right. In a sense, really, all of it was sort of hopelessly tainted by this reality.
Yes, and really the fundamental issue is that she was analyzing the past through 21st century glasses.
Right.
Through the lens of our contemporary values, which is something that you would think a history professor would know better than to do.
Right. So you decided that it was really important for the full story of your family to be told, and you took this upon yourself. Explain the kind of resources that were available to you in order for you to unlock so much information about your family over the course of more than 10 generations.
Well, my ancestors decided many, many years ago in 1723 to save every scrap of paper, which is both a blessing and a curse, because today our family archive is one of the largest in America. It's all in Providence, Rhode Island, partly at Brown, partly at the Rhode Island Historical Society. So the information is there, but no one really, until I came along, had tried to analyze the whole arc of the family story. And I'm not a historian, so I needed a lot of help from specialists who could read 18th century manuscripts. I really blessed the invention of the typewriter. And it took me 12 years, because I wasn't doing this full time, and I needed to teach myself a lot of American history. Like most people, in school, I learned about the Revolution and the Civil War and what happened in between the whole birth of the nation, the growing pains of the new republic completely eluded me. So it was a learning process on many levels for me as well.
Right. I think at one point in the book you say something about how this enormous treasure trove of information was, you say something like it was both a blessing and a curse, in that, it fell to you to make sense of all of this and then to try to, from all of this, craft some kind of coherent narrative of this family and its long, complicated history. That could not have been easy.
No, and on top of that, the Browns were Baptists, so they were pretty fundamentalist Christians early on, and they didn't really believe in expressing their emotions in writing. So I had to do a lot of reading between the lines because I wanted to make the characters come alive. I wanted to understand their passions and what was driving them. But there are so many similarities between the 19th century, particularly the years I focus on, the Jacksonian era, and today, that I found it, this research absolutely fascinating. And that's what kept me going.
We're speaking with Sylvia Brown about her book, Grappling with Legacy, which explores the long, rich, in interesting history of the Brown family, and Brown University bears that name. And the Brown family has been right at the heart of American history. In many respects, the history of this family is a reflection of our nation's own overall history, as this family grappled with many of the same issues with which we as a nation have had to grapple through the course of time. Explain the way in which your family, that is the Brown family, was ultimately able to build a considerable fortune.
The Browns were initially merchants in the 18th century, and they had a particularly strong flair for the concept of value added. So at a time when Britain would not allow the colonies to manufacture anything, they found the very few items that they could transform and make more valuable. So, for example, they took whale oil and turned it into candles. They found iron ore in Rhode Island and turned it into iron and nails and cannon. They took molasses and turned them into rum. And in that way, they were able to build a trading network that spread to the Caribbean and to England. And then in the 19th century, they moved to manufacturing. They built the first textile mill in America, and they got into the cotton manufacturing business in a very big way, and also in all the ancillary products of the Industrial Revolution, so banking and insurance and roads and canals and railways. And they were really a part of the transformation of the American economy from a rural and merchant economy to an industrial economy.
Mm.
I
wanted to say that I am especially intrigued by the fifth generation of your family, when we have this array of four brothers, and you describe each of them so vividly, and also the way in which each of them had their own particular gifts, their own particular perspectives, and they work together in a way that had to give such energy and vitality to the family as a whole.
Yeah, they were the dream team. There was the perfect chief executive, there was the chief technical officer, there was the financial and marketing genius. They were really an ideal team of four partners for a short while. Then they all split up and went their own ways. But blood always ran thicker than water, or still does today in my family, and they continued to help each other even when they were no longer partners. And even though they differed fundamentally on issues such as slavery, One brother was an ardent abolitionist. The other brother believed that a businessman should be able to trade in anything he wished, even slaves. But they always stayed united as a family.
Right. And at some point, as you discuss this fifth generation, we see the phrase, gentlemen of public responsibility. What did that mean in that time and place? We're talking now about the mid to late 18th century.
Well, in the 18th century, society was very hierarchical. And people believed that charity was necessary to keep the poor in their place and to sort of grease the wheels of society so that there wouldn't be any public disruption. It's a very different view of the world from the one we have today. And so it was the job of those who were wealthy and educated to dispense public good, to do public works. But the fundamental issue for the Browns was that a gentleman was someone who didn't need to work, was a man of leisure who had the time to spend on public service and on doing good works. And that was possible in the South, where plantation owners had slave labor. But in the North, merchants couldn't afford not to work because they all depended on the vagaries of trade. And so the Brown brothers, once they became prosperous, were desperate to find ways to appear as gentlemen. And of course, they could buy the trappings of that status with furniture and silver and build nice houses. But they also felt they had to do good works for their community to be seen as true gentlemen. And that led them to bring a college to Providence, to build the main church, the market house, to pave the streets, to build the first school, to serve in the legislature. But I have to add, this was not altruism. This is not what we call philanthropy today. It was self-interested benevolence, because anything they did to benefit Providence ultimately benefited them. So a very, very different way of looking at society and the issues of society, which has dramatically evolved to what we believe today.
Hmm. So one of the central figures in your book is Nicholas Brown II, who I believe is your great-great-grandfather. Am I remembering that correctly?
A little more greats than that.
Oh, okay. So even more.
He was born in 1769, so a few more greats.
Absolutely. Sorry about that. I didn't count quite right. But at any rate, he's really central to the story, and in a sense, the fortunes of the family are greatly enriched at this point in time, at least in part because of an important partnership with someone by the name of Thomas Ives. Explain what was at the heart of this partnership and the way in which this sort of changed things for the family.
Well, this is all happening now after the Revolution, when America is a new republic with basically no economic assets that has to reinvent itself. And the Brown family was very fortunate because they had invested in war bonds, and thanks to Alexander Hamilton's assumption of state debt, they made a lot of money on these war bonds.
Mm.
And Nicholas was the only son of this generation of four brothers we've just been talking about, who went on to become a successful businessman and to produce heirs and descendants to this day. And his father had taken in a young orphan who turned out to have a remarkable business acumen, Thomas Ives, the man you mentioned. And fortunately, Thomas Ives fell in love with Nicholas's sister, Hope Brown. And so Nicholas inherited money from his father, but also had as a partner and brother-in-law and best friend the remarkable Thomas Ives. And the two of them created a firm called Brown and Ives, which exists to this day, and launched into the China trade and then later into manufacturing and all the other investments that I mentioned, banking, insurance, infrastructure. And that really allowed the family to do well in the 19th century.
Right.
And that is what funded the philanthropy.
Hmm. And this is a partnership that is a little bit rocky in the early going, and one of the stories of Brown and Ives is of surmounting some of those some of that early turbulence to form a partnership that was tremendously successful.
Yes, absolutely. Well, they had to reinvent themselves. America was a blank slate at the time, and older people that surrounded them didn't believe in the China trade. It seemed far too risky, but they were willing to try it, and they were very, very successful in China and in Java with coffee.
Hmm. So explain what, as far as you can tell, was the primary impetus for Nicholas Brown II to pour so much of his resources into legacy, and explain in part why this had at least something to do with his own two sons and their intentions.
Well, Nicholas, as I mentioned, was born in 1769, so he was a real child of the 18th century. He had been steeped in this very hierarchical society where everyone had his place. And the America of his childhood was a rural America where everyone knew what they had to do. And then by the time you get to the 19th century, you have a revolution, a social revolution taking place. You have the rise of cities, you have industrialization, you have immigrants pouring in and people moving out west. And it's a very chaotic and turbulent time. Politics become very partisan, especially in the Jacksonian era. There are riots taking place. And Nicholas was absolutely distressed by this. He had grown up during very stressful times, during the revolution and the economic depression that followed, and he desperately wanted to see law and order around him. And just the opposite was happening. And then his beloved maritime commerce, he was a merchant through and through, was ending as America became more industrialized. And worse, his two sons were not following in their father's footsteps. This was another hallmark of the 19th century. Sons started going their own way and no longer listening to their father. And he was deeply distressed by all this. So he turned to the one institution he could still influence, which was the college on the hill that now bore his name. He'd given a gift in 1804, and the name of the college had been changed to Brown University. And he decided to pour money into it, to give the young men at the college the moral compass they would need to navigate the era's stormy seas. He wanted to create a generation of leaders who could take America forward, but who were compassionate and who had the right moral principles. And so I posit that this concept we have today, which is so much a part of the American character, that a university can be an agent of social change. I say that this started with Nicholas Brown in Rhode Island decades before the Gilded Age, decades before the era we always think of as being the great era for universities.
Right.
And this sense of being altruistic, of giving to for the future, really started with Nicholas Brown.
Fascinating. Your family now is not, as you yourself say in the book, your family is not what it once was in terms of the sort of money that you collectively have in your pockets. Your family does not have the wealth that it once does, but you still care very deeply about some of these issues, and in particular the way in which people who do have extensive resources think about what to do with them. How do you think Americans are thinking about these issues now? And do you want them to be thinking about these questions and these possibilities differently?
Well, what you're saying is absolutely true. I don't command the resources of my grandfather or even my father, because my family have been philanthropists now for 4 or 5 generations and not businessmen. So most of the money has been given away. And it's something, yes, it's in my DNA. So my challenge is to leverage the resources I have to do the most good. And I decided that the best way I could do that was by helping people become smarter donors, not just the ultra wealthy, not just people who have access to private banks or donor advisors or consultants, but the majority of Americans who give money away and who really want to know that their dollar is going to the right place, that what they're doing has the maximum impact, but who often have no idea where to turn to get that information.
The book really gets us thinking about what has been done before and what might be done in the past, what might be done in the years to come. And you really see where we are right now as a kind of a dramatic moment when it comes to philanthropy and the transfer of wealth.
Yes, there's going to be a massive transfer of wealth in the next 50 years. Between 40 and 60 trillion dollars, of which 27 trillion will go to charitable causes. So it's very important that we become smarter about our giving. You know, only 85% of Americans spend less than 2 hours a year researching their giving. So it means that most people currently are just writing checks without really thinking about where they're giving. And the concept of maximizing impact, the sense about giving with clarity and confidence, these need to be honed. So what I have done is launched a product that's a course. I take people away for 5 days, 3 days of learning through workshops and site visits, and a 2-day volunteer experience that balances the head and the heart, because the heart is very important in philanthropy. And I take people away to locations that provide good case studies so that they can come home inspired and equipped to give more thoughtfully to any cause of their choosing. And that's called Uplifting Journeys.
And there's more information about you and this at your website, which is SylviaBrownSmartDonors.com. And your book, once again, is Grappling with Legacy, Rhode Island's Brown Family and the American Philanthropic Impulse. The book is published by Archway. Sylvia Brown, thank you so much for joining me on The Morning Show today. I really enjoyed this, and I really learned a lot. Best wishes.
Thank you, Greg.
Part two of today's morning show is coming up in just a moment here on WGTD. The time is exactly 8:39. I have a feeling that many of you know the name W. Bruce Cameron. He is the best-selling author of A Dog's Purpose, a really huge book. And he is also well-known for its best-selling sequel, A Dog's Journey. And I am so excited to be able to reconnect now with W. Bruce Cameron to talk about his book called The Dogs of Christmas. It is an absolutely lovely novel in which we meet a young man named Josh who finds his relatively simple life turned upside down with the unexpected arrival of a pregnant dog, and then that dog's pups or other puppies that suddenly find themselves in his life. And it's nothing he's prepared for, nothing he's ever experienced before. But he manages to embrace this unexpected new reality in his life with surprising success. And indeed, it is a heartwarming and inspiring story in so many, many respects. And I'm very excited to be able to speak now with W. Bruce Cameron about his latest book. W. Bruce Cameron, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg.
Good to be talking with you again. I really I love the dedication of the book to the people all over the world who have opened their hearts and their homes to orphaned animals. I thought that would be a really good place to start. You obviously have a great love of animals yourself, and particularly dogs. But I wonder if this matter of taking in orphaned animals resonates with you on some kind of personal level due to maybe personal experience or other ways in which you've come to really appreciate what a loving gesture it is when somebody does this.
Oh, yeah. I would say that the message of the Dogs of Christmas is a question, and the question is, do we rescue animals or do they rescue us? As you so you put it very succinctly and well when you summed up the plot of the book, you've got a young man named Josh who is isolated and alone. He sort of lives like a mountain man up in Colorado, in Evergreen, Colorado. And then everything changes. His life gets completely upended when these dogs show up. He is unprepared for it and unprepared for the changes it'll make in his life. But eventually, of course, they turn out to be positive, and why wouldn't they be? It's a box full of puppies at Christmas. I mean, that's going to cheer anybody up.
Right.
But the plot, the actual the basis was inspired by the story of my own little dog Tucker, who was a rescue dog who was dropped off still slick from birth, brand new dog, was dropped off at a shelter in a box, and they just happened to have a lactating German Shepherd who had just weaned her pups. And I think they brought the box of puppies in and said something like, "Hey, remember that wild weekend at the Sigma Chi house? Because here you go," and introduced a new box of puppies, and this dog took care of him. And that's how I got my dog, Tucker. And Tucker has indeed rescued me. I was in the doldrums because I thought I was never going to adopt a dog again. But in a similar fashion to Josh and the Dogs of Christmas, my daughter rescued Tucker. She actually runs a rescue in Denver. And she called me and said, "I'm bringing you this dog." And that let me know that, you know, you lose a dog and you say, "I can't go through that again." And then you get another dog and you think, "What was I thinking? Why didn't I do this before?"
It's interesting how Josh is, in a sense, exactly the right choice for somebody who can be kind of transformed by this experience. In that, I mean, he's by all evidence a great guy, but someone who's basically never owned a dog before, and a very typical guy in the sense of having a lot of deep feelings, but not particularly good at expressing them, and some other ways in which you know, he's exactly the kind of guy whose sort of barriers are almost inevitably going to come down. What else did you think about in creating this central character of Josh and making him interesting and someone familiar to us and yet not just kind of a cookie cutter caricature?
Yeah, when I wrote The Dogs of Christmas, what I was intrigued by is how we in today's society seem to be both more social and less social. We're spending more time on social media. We're texting people. We're emailing people. But we're spending less and less time with people. It's easy now to spend your entire day sitting in front of the computer and feel as if you've had a lot of great social interactions. And I suppose by some definitions you have, but you're not interacting with anything but your fingertips perhaps. You know, you're just not, and you're very coldly exchanging these text messages. I wanted to write a story about someone who is going into that world sort of not involuntarily, but willingly, and in doing so, was losing his heart a little bit. And then along come the dogs of Christmas and pull him back out. You know, you can't text with your dog. You have to take your dog for a walk. You have to interact with your dog. And I wanted to write about how you can find the human side of yourself if you just know where to look. And if where to look is nosing you because he wants to go out in the yard for a walk, I think that's a pretty helpful thing in the world.
We're speaking with W. Bruce Cameron about his newest book called The Dogs of Christmas. Another very, very important character in this book is Carrie, who works at the local animal shelter. And one of the things that's so striking, I hate to give too much away, but you should say that the very first encounter between Josh and Carrie, which is over the phone, is not a very positive one. And and actually, in some ways, we're not given all that positive a first impression of who Carrie is and what she's like. Tell us about her and about this first encounter which Josh has with Carrie over the phone.
Yeah, Josh, Josh has these puppies and feels like the thing you do when you have puppies is you call the animal rescue people and they come get them. As far as he's concerned, that's the method. He doesn't know any different. Carrie, when she answers the phone, is very cold toward him because what Josh doesn't know is that in animal rescue, they don't have the resources to sit and bottle feed puppies. And in this case, what would be happening, and again, not to give too much away, but Josh believes that the proper course is to give over the puppies themselves and not Lucy, the lactating shepherd that he has. So that's complicated. I don't want to get into that. But Carrie's response is really cold because to her, what Josh is saying is, I'm gonna drop off these puppies for you to euthanize, because that's what would have to happen. They can't do it any other way. And a lot of people don't know that about dropping puppies off at a, they have to be weaned or their chances of survival are nil at a shelter. Yeah, and Carrie. I know a lot of people in animal rescue, and Carrie is sort of a compilation of those people. They're very strong-willed. They have seen enough startlingly inhuman behavior on the part of people abandoning or abusing animals, and they have to have a strong spine to put up with that. And that is Carrie. She comes off very abrasive at first.
Absolutely.
Because she's very protective of the dogs.
Absolutely. And so exasperated with people, and especially someone as clueless as Josh, who is completely clueless when it comes to this new situation in which he finds himself. And yet then the first time we meet Carrie in person, which is when she actually makes her way to his rather remote home to see these puppies for herself, and with the puppies, she is as warm and cuddly and loving and tender-hearted as anyone could possibly be. And I thought that was really intriguing. It's probably something that we've seen before in a sense, but I think you do an especially good job of painting that picture very persuasively of someone who can interact with a box of puppies very differently than she interacts with a whole lot of human beings in her life.
Oh yeah, I mean, and from the moment he sees her, Josh he's pretty interested in Carrie, and he immediately sets out to try to court her very awkwardly, and does a really poor job. It feels very real to my own life, where you know, in the courtship phase of my life, I've always given myself pretty much Fs. I've never been very good at it. And Josh is sort of like that. He's just not very good at trying to entice this woman. She's over there to see the dogs of Christmas, but he wants her to be around to see him. Hmm. And I think one of the most fun things I've written is this slow dance between Carrie and Josh, where we're just not sure if Carrie's interested in Josh. He seems to blow it every time he talks to her, and yet she keeps coming back. What does that mean? That's the kind of stuff that feels very real to me in romance.
Absolutely. Another whole layer to this book has to do with Josh and his own family. And with many of his family members, he has either complicated or distant relationships. And this is also something that I think you do a really good job of painting very realistic portraits here of these relationships fraught with various complexities or difficulties of one kind or another. Tell us a little bit about where that comes from, or maybe just try to describe the care with which you tried to describe these relationships and make them feel so authentic.
Yeah, when I was writing the Dogs of Christmas, what I wanted to portray was a man, and this Josh, who is has built up a defensive wall against the world without really realizing it. He thinks he is embracing the important things of life and keeping them alive, but what he's really doing is refusing to move on. He just can't seem to cope with the fact that his family doesn't live in the house where he lives. This is his childhood home that he has arranged to wind up with, and he actually bought it back on the market. So he lives in his family's home. That's kind of an odd thing for someone to do. But to Josh, it makes sense, and he wishes he had all the old Christmas decorations that his mom had because, in a way, that's his defense against the changing world, and that is his... that's where his hurt kind of comes out. He's got a lot of hurt in him because of some things that happened in his family. And that's something that Carrie can help him with, because she, in her no-nonsense ways, can sniff out these problems that he's got and expose them to the light and let him see that he needs to move on. And he manages to decide that Carrie is worth it, that he's willing to abandon some of these long-held principles and preconditions of existence that he's been wrestling with, because he is so enticed by this Carrie woman.
Your book also takes us into the really sensitive arena of what it means to take someone in when there is this very real possibility that someone will come along and take them right back out of your life again, particularly when it comes to something like opening your home to what might be a lost animal or a stolen animal or whatever. And I think a lot of us, if we've never walked this particular road, don't stop to think about what that would feel like, and in particular, the real danger that is there, that you are opening yourself up to an enormous load of hurt if suddenly all of this, in a sense, gets reversed in a way that is beyond your control.
Yeah, I think one of the lessons that Josh learns in The Dogs of Christmas is a lesson that dogs teach us, and that is that regardless of the circumstances, they are temporary visitors in our lives. When we adopt dogs and we bring dogs into our house, we know it's a temporary arrangement. We know that they have short lifespans. We do it anyway because of the joy they bring us. And then I really think one of the most important things they do for us is they teach us that even though life is short, it can be lived joyfully. And a lot of times I will catch myself so preoccupied with some project and so focused that I've sort of lost track of the point of life, which is to be joyful and to love life. And when I realize I'm doing that, I try to go back and live life like the dogs. I try to say that every day is worth living and that I should find something to be happy about every day, because, look, that's what dogs do. I mean, they're no matter what's going on, they're happy to be doing it. They want to get in the car, they want to get out of the car, you know. they think everything's great. Why can't we live like that? And they when they're leaving us, they're leaving us with a legacy of joy and optimism that I think we should embrace. Mm. And hopefully in The Dogs of Christmas, you know, you've got puppies at Christmas. It's a great gift book. It's a great little story that's I hope makes people happy and makes them forget about problems for a little while and just concentrate on a sweet story at Christmas time. That's the aim.
Right. And, of course, one of the central themes of this book is one which has run through several of your previous books as well. At one point when Carrie and Josh are having what in many respects is kind of a difficult conversation about what you and I were just talking about, she is trying to explain to Josh, because being with us is a dog's purpose, Josh. We bred the species to be that way. The ones that didn't want to live with people weren't allowed to reproduce. So after thousands of years, it's literally in their blood. That is, dogs are meant to be with us. It's what makes them happy. And in a sense, when we allow it to make us happy too, you have a very, very special relationship there indeed.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm so happy that you called out that segment of the book, because to me that is one of the most moving scenes in the book, because that's how I feel about dogs. I mean, a dog's purpose, a dog's journey. I wouldn't have written so many books with a dog on the cover if it weren't for the fact that I just feel that they're here with a very special purpose.
I want to make a quick mention of the fact too that along the way we learn a lot about dogs. And for instance, there's a pregnant dog in this book who gives birth to pups. And there's all kinds of interesting information that we learn along the way. And as I recall, I think in your acknowledgments, there's somebody in your life who is really responsible for helping you have all of this kind of fun knowledge about body temperature and what to feed a pregnant dog and the new puppies and how to feed them. And I mean, a lot of that interesting information is like a wonderful little bonus along the way.
Yeah, I have a couple of veterinarian friends that I abuse on a regular basis by picking up the phone and calling and asking, okay, what's the story here? You know, what would happen if this happened? I continually ask them. They must get tired of getting those phone calls. But, you know, I'm an author. My job in writing The Dogs of Christmas was to tell a good story and to try to adhere to, you know, the facts about dogs. But I'm not a veterinarian. I didn't go to vet school. So when it comes time to trying to come up with this stuff, I have to turn to the experts. I would hate it if somebody read one of my books it happens all the time. I'll get some fact wrong, generally because I thought I knew what I was talking about. So I have to be very disciplined in recognizing that I seldom know what I'm talking about. And I just, my job is to write down what the smart people say. That's what I'm supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great book on all kinds of different levels, and not just for what we sort of learn along the way, but for also the way in which we grow very, very attached to both the human beings and the dogs that are in this lovely book, The Dogs of Christmas, published by Forge. And W. Bruce Cameron, congratulations on yet another lovely book. I am so glad we had the chance to speak about it today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you.
And the time is 8:58 here on WGTD. And we have some interesting morning shows coming up for you next week that I hope you will make a point of listening to. On Monday, an interview with a woman named Laura Pritchett, who's written a very intriguing book called Making Friends with Death. And it's surprisingly lighthearted and also a very intriguing and potentially helpful book about some ways in which we can think about how our life here on Earth is going to end and how we want it to end. Not that we always have much in the way of a say, but there are certain things that we can at least attempt to make happen in terms of where we want to be, who we want to be surrounded with, what we want done upon our death, and so on. And this book is something of a primer, kind of a workbook to help people kind of think about some of those intriguing questions. And we'll be airing that on on Monday's morning show. Tuesday, we'll be looking at the world of wine through the eyes of a longtime wine connoisseur, Robert Chilton, whose book is called Adventures in Old Vines. And Wednesday, I'll be airing an interview with the editor of a book called This is the Place.